Good evening, everyone. Good evening.
My name is Sebo Aslanian. I'm the Mitchell Vanisian Chair of Modern Armenian History here. We're honored to have Professor Vanisian among us today, the person who took over his position. And I'm thankful for all of you for being here. It's very nice to see such large numbers, especially young people, for this talk. So today's talk is titled Daily Life in the Abyss, Genocide Diaries 1915 to 1918. And it is given to us by a distinguished scholar of Ottoman Armenian history, the history of the Armenian genocide, the history of Western Armenians, and so on, Vahe Tashjian. And I'll say a few words about Vahe just so that you can contextualize his work in the context of his larger scholarship. Vahe earned his PhD in history and civilization at the École des Hautes Études en Sciences Sociales in Paris. He is now the chief editor in Berlin of the website known as Ushamadian, which is a website for Western Armenian history. It's fascinating. If you haven't visited, you should talk to the author afterwards. His main publications are La France en Cilicie et en Haute Mésopotamie, published in 2004, Les Arméniens, 1917-1939, La Quête d'un Refuge, in 2007, of which he's a co-editor. Ottoman Armenians, Life, Culture, Society, he's the editor of that volume, published in only 4 years ago in Berlin, 2014. And most recently, he is the author of a very promising monograph in a microhistorical kind of take on the Armenian genocide and the survivor experience. And the work is titled Daily Life in the Abyss, Genocide Diaries 1915 to 1918, and it was published by Bergham Press, if I'm not mistaken, Oxford, New York, in 2017. We have copies of the book for sale in the back for those of you who are interested. Later on, maybe after the talk is over, they're at a discounted price. It's paperback. And so, without further delay, actually, one additional note before I forget. It would be remiss of me if I didn't ask for you to do this. If you don't have already, if you're not already on our mailing list of lectures that the Vitrio Venetian Chair organizes on an annual basis, we have 10, 15, 20 lectures a year. We have usually conferences, at least one conference a year, sometimes two. If you're not on the mailing list to receive our announcements and so on, then I ask you to go to the back and talk to Daniel Ohanian, my graduate student, and fill out your name and email address. We'll be very happy to incorporate you into that list. So thank you all once again for coming. Vahe will speak to us for 40, 45 minutes, and then we will have a good half hour or so, or maybe longer, for questions and answers following his lecture. So thank you very much, Vahe, for accepting our invitation, and thank you all again.
Thank you, Sebu, and thank you for this wonderful invitation. Just a couple of words about an experience that I'm living now in my U.S. tour, because I was in New York, I was in New Jersey, and in California now. And I'm presenting two subjects, two lectures. One is about this book. It's about two genocide diaries, and the other is about Ushamadian, the website. It's about the life of the Armenians before 1915 in the Ottoman Empire. So the one Ushamadian, this is based on my experience. Yeah, it's very easy to present. It's jovial. There are music. There are podcasts. There are about the life of the Armenians. And here it's about something else. So I warn you, it will not be easy to follow a lecture today. And another experience that I'm also experiencing this couple of days. It's not really easy for someone to present his own book, yeah. And so instead of presenting here the general content of the book, I will just focus on one or two episodes one or two episodes which are largely described in the last two chapters of the book. And so by doing so, it will not you will not have a general knowledge of the content of the book. The different stories, different protagonists of the book, the evolution of the survival, the struggle to survival. But on a positive note, I will analyze here one of the fundamental issues that Armenian deportees encountered during genocide. And yeah, this is first the and when I say the deportees, this concerns a particular zone. I will talk about it, Bilad al-Sham. And this fundamental issue is the demoralization and the weakening of the struggle to survive. So I will present here different aspects of this. Demoralization of this decline. We can call it also the evolution of the resistance, because I would consider it as a resistance. And this is not a very good idea. The map I will show just in the beginning. So just I will tell you that now you can I don't need the light, and just I will show the map for a few minutes, and then you we can use again the for which you can and so I will present you different aspects of this decline, of this resistance, based and the main diarist of the book, and the main diarist is Dernerse Savukcian, the priest from Aintab. And again, I found this episode fundamental to understand how Armenians lived in the extreme conditions of deportation in Bilad al-Sham. So Bilad al-Sham, this is an important geographical place that will occur several times in my presentation. And the two diarists, Dernerses, his family, Grigor Bogarian, his family, and among others, hundreds of thousands of other Aintab Armenians were deported there in this particular region. So this is the region, Bilad al-Sham, south of Aleppo, and it included the region of Hama, Salamiya, Homs, Damascus, Dera, until the Sina Peninsula. And this whole region was under the command of Cemal Pasha, the head of the 4th Ottoman Army. And what we know also in genocide studies, this is a very well-known subject, topic, that in this particular region, the Armenians were not subject to mass slaughter. And this was in contrast to the other region, to the region of Erzurum, this and Mosul, all this region, when we know that the most violent collective massacres happened during the same period. Yes, there was a relative security that Armenians enjoyed in Bilad al-Sham. Cemal Pasha later in his memoirs tried to create the impression that he had purely humanitarian motives for taking the deported Armenians into his protection in Bilad al-Sham. I can say that based on the information provided by the two diarists, the situation of Aintab Armenians was relatively safe. Okay, I forgot to say that. It was relatively safe during the first years of deportation, and mostly when they left Aintab, and Aintab on this map is here. So they left Aintab and they went, these two families and with them many other Aintab Armenians, and from Aintab they went to Hama. They stayed in Hama, and a couple of months ago, many Aintab Armenians went to Salamiya, the neighboring town, and from Salamiya, the family of Nerses went back to Hama. So this was the region where the deportees and his two families were deported. And we know that during their way from Aintab to Hama, these Armenians, these deported Armenians, didn't suffer or didn't lose their belongings. There were no attacks on them. And they took the train, and after a few days they arrived to Aleppo, and from Aleppo they took again the train and arrived in Hama. That means they took also all their belongings with them. All their belongings with them, and during the first years, many families lived based on what they had. So they started to sell some house belongings, and this is a way to continue their survival in this region. This relatively secure social and economic situation of the Nerses, Krikor Bogaryan, and their families, and more generally the groups of Aintab Armenians, began to disintegrate in 1917. Early 1917, an economic crisis hit Hama region, but also the whole Bilad al-Sham, not only this Hama region, but also all this area of Bilad al-Sham. There was a very deep economic crisis. Just a couple of examples. We know that the price of staple foods in Hama and Salamiya increased by 1,000% and more, putting the majority of deportees in an unbearable situation. And this information is mostly provided by Krikor Bogaryan. Krikor Bogaryan at that time was an 18-year-old young Armenian, a student of Aintab school. And but what is interesting in his diary that he provided every time in many daily jottings the information about the daily prices in market in Hama and Salamiya. And this is precious information, and based on this information you can see the evolution of the prices from 1915 until 1917. Yes, and so the situation of the deportees became unbearable, and in these extreme conditions, the deportees were ready to make all sorts of compromises for the sake of surviving. So I will start from that period, 1917, and I will omit the other 2 years, 1915 and 1916, which in my opinion are also very important to understand the daily life of the Armenians in this particular region. Until 1917, catastrophic descriptions or commentaries are not frequent by our two diarists. It may be presumed that the catastrophe, with its violence and mortal consequences, have not yet touched their family members, close relatives, or the Aintab community. The description or the depiction of this situation in Dernes's diary changes radically in 1917 and 1918. And this is a time when Bogaryan, the other diarist, already stopped keeping a diary for different reasons. I have some supposition or why he stopped to keep a diary, but this is not... I will omit this topic too, this important issue too, and I will continue and my presentation based on the information provided by their nurses, who continued to keep a diary. From 1917 on, descriptions of demoralization begin to predominate in their nurses' diary, and very likely this is related to the economic and social changes that took place in the local environment. And we have to do here with a catastrophic situation of a type that has been the object of many studies in the case of Jewish Holocaust. It concerns a category of defenseless people who are not only in desperate predicament, but are also demoralized and despondent. Their struggle has lost its momentum, their power of resistance has been exhausted, and they have lost their will. The NSS, too, has long descriptions of people in this state. I think that these passages in the NSS diaries are a rarity, they are not usual in Armenian survivors' writings and undoubtedly represent the most valuable aspect of the priest's diary. In the other eyewitness accounts, generally speaking, of course there are exceptions, the authors confine themselves either to a chronological narration of events or to general descriptions of scenes. And absent from these accounts are penetrating views of their inner spaces, of the deportees' lives, sociological or philosophical commentary, or profound analysis. But it is true when Dernersès himself reflects on the deportees' demoralization, or generally speaking, on their decline, his motivations are often religious. For him, in other words, the deportees' decline resided in the fact that they had distanced themselves from the Christian faith and neglected the ceremonies, its ceremonies and rituals. And for this reason, his analysis often has a theological coloration. But these passages represent only one part of his descriptions. Dernersès, this paragon of a meticulous priest, also had close contact with all the strata, all the categories of, of his community of deportees. He was an eyewitness to what was happening on the ground, who exhorted and encouraged his flock and did what he could to halt their accelerating demoralization. And as a result, his daily jottings reflect the reactions of a despondent priest who directly experienced that decline and tried to understand and analyze the deportees' unusual mode of life, while simultaneously condemning their indifference and utter passivity, as well as their renunciation of social and Christian values. And from this point on, Dernersès became the author of an eyewitness account of a moral decline. Apparent scenes of decline were visible on the ground. The number of deaths was gradually increasing, and unburied Armenian bodies could be seen in Hama's street, the Hama where Dernersès was deported. And for Dernersès, one of the most shocking signs of demoralization is the sight of dead Armenians who had been left without protectors. In his capacity as priest, he knew a great deal about the domestic lives of the families around him and about the tragedies that were taking place within these families. And early 1918, the priest from Aintab visited the caves near Hama. These are caves that are located on the hills near the banks of Orontes, so within the city, the Orontes River, which is also the Asi River, is called in Arabic. And these caves had become shelters for impoverished Armenian deportees, and in every one of these caves, dozens of families were living piled up on one another. Dernersès was manifestly much affected by the sight, and he writes about this view. I was confronted, this is a passage from Dernersès' diary, I was confronted with a dreadful, wrenching condition. Families of 8 to 10 members lie there, squeezed together, withered, dejected. Large numbers of once strapping young men are so faint with hunger that they lie stretched out on the ground, ignoring even those who call out to them. Whenever they catch sight of someone, those who stole have breath left in them cry out, "Bread, give us bread." Dernersès writes that there was even one man in these caves, among these Armenians living in these caves, who said that he preferred that he and others like him should serve as feed for dogs after they died. Dernersès found the incident terrifying, and he wrote that very day in his diary. "Ah, what a terrible condition. It has become natural for that most sensitive of all creatures, man, to picture the body of his loved ones as food for the ravenous beasts that feed on corpses. He can bear that." And it seems that in these lines, Dernersès' religious and human feelings had become one. This indifference to the dead is for him a supreme embodiment of moral degradation and the utter defeat of the struggle for survival. And it is on this occasion that he produces, in my opinion, one of the most impressive passages in his diary. He writes, "Are there still deeper levels of misery? How deep can one descend? We go one step further down every day. We think that we have taken the last step, but then we see that there must be still deeper depths. We will ever find the bottom of these endless abysses and start to climb back up out of them." And here, Dernesses is actually describing the stratum of morally degraded deportees for whom the race against time is already over. They are physically spent, or as the priest often puts it, withered, chortsats in Armenian. Had someone given them bread, they would certainly not have refused it, but beyond that, lacked all spirit of enterprise or even common sense. In other words, these people had adopted a waiting attitude. Sooner or later, death would come on its own and take their lives. Now it is interesting to know how does Dernesses qualify the remaining deportees? I mean, those who were, relatively speaking, better able to continue the struggle to survive, those who had not yet succumbed to the extreme conditions, had to scramble every day to obtain a little more food, to stay healthy, to avoid making a false step, a false move. Primo Levi, a survivor of the Nazi camps, has a very rich description of this category of camp inmates in his books. For him, in extreme conditions, like the life of the inmates in Nazi camps, one has to fight against the current to resist enemies and have no pity for rivals. And on this subject he writes, I quote, "One has to throttle all dignity and kill all conscience to climb down into the arena as a beast against other beasts." We can find such descriptions in other books about Nazi camps. One of them is Frederick Homer's book. He writes that the inmates of the camps had concluded a Hobbesian social contract. Hobbesian, from Thomas Hobbes, the philosopher. That means they started to react as selfish, or they started to adopt a selfish attitude. In other words, the prisoners who failed to adopt these harsh principles and who did not practice the very often unscrupulous art of survival were ineluctably condemned to decline. Dernesses' interrogations are not cast in this mold. For him, the catastrophe took the form in the deportees' ranks of general demoralization and immorality. He did not see demoralization only in the fact that they left their relatives' corpses unburied, we have seen in the example. The moral decline that Dernesses describes was more comprehensive. It did not involve only the wretched or the exhausted. And he writes on this subject, "Unfortunately, immorality of every kind is spreading day by day. And in the state in which this deportation has left us, what has done our nation the greatest harm is the intensifying immorality on all sides. Woe to the Armenian nation. It was unimaginable that it would fall so low. But this has been a natural process, and it has now reached its term." In the same way in which Dernesses bewails the Armenians' deepening immorality, he denounces their bestialization. The noun echoes frequently in his diary, Anasnatum in Armenian, where it sometimes designates a generalized state that extends to the majority of deportees of all social strata, and here is what he writes on this subject. "The rich and the poor alike are becoming more like animals every day. The bestialization of the poor is due to their exhaustion, which is caused by the suffering due to hunger. That of the rich stems from their fear of an uncertain future. With the ignominious deaths caused by starvation before their eyes, their minds, hearts, and souls are diminished. They start to behave like animals and lose all feeling. Brother even turns ruthlessly against brother. Here then, the subject is a generalized moral decline. The priest from Eintop, Der Nerses, judges these deportees with extreme severity. They have conspicuously estranged themselves from the Christian faith, and the spirit of intra-community assistance has died in them. The lives of such people are distinguished by their selfishness. The individuals Der Nerses depicts were people in whom the social contract had been fundamentally ruptured, which in fact, in a way, is a way of ensuring their survival. Their life was not yet on the final mortal dead end road. They continued to pursue their race against time, but simultaneously they exhibited a great indifference to compatriots who are in desperate situation. Der Nerses is convinced that the spirit of mutual assistance had already disappeared in the community in Hama Salamiya area. That means it existed before in 1915, 1916, and it disappeared in 1917, 1918. Der Nerses is convinced that this was at bottom a consequence of the increasingly miserable conditions there. Was it possible in such an environment for the deportees to strive to remain true to themselves, to honor the social and moral rules that they professed, to avoid the compromises of principle that extreme conditions imposed on them? Again, Der Nerses has a characteristic answer to these questions. He writes, "For a people which, like this one, is living in an evil empire, a handful of individuals who shine like stars of the first magnitude, there are perhaps 10 such people among the Armenians who number in tens of thousands, stars that, with all their moral strength, earn and give and help others as they should." These lines recall, again, the books of Primo Levi, who writes that only a very few people manage to survive without sacrificing part of their moral code. He calls people of this sort superior individuals, embodiments of martyr and descent. Another expert of Nazi camps, but also of Soviet gulags, Tsvetan Todorov, for his part, observes that in the world of the camps, and the witness of the survivors themselves, acts of heroism or saintliness were few and far between. But let us once again give the floor to Der Nerses about this issue, who in the environment in which he lived, which had become bestial and immoral in his own words, points to the existence of heroes and describes his own vision of them, and he writes about this. "Heroes, perfect believers, too, are always to be found among those who are dying of starvation, people who courageously battle all sorts of difficulties and in the end commend their soul to God, triumphing spiritually, even if they are physically defeated." So how should we understand these lines? For the priest from Eintop, the hero, the antithesis of selfish, Hobbesian hero, described by Levi, Homer, Todorov, and many other experts of Nazi camps, was an individual who worked honestly to earn his living, lived in a spirit of devotion and self-sacrifice, so this is the description of Der Nerses himself, was ready to help others, was free from sexual aberrations, displayed exemplary conduct, did not fornicate, and was faithful to his Christian faith. The question, was Der Nerses himself not one of the people who corresponded to this type? Was he himself not one of the little group of perhaps 10, in his own words, superior people? We do in fact find all these qualities united in his person in the first years of the deportation, even when conditions were at their most extreme. Yet, I am inclined to classify the priest from Eintop as rather a Hobbesian man. In other words, I am inclined to place him among the ranks of those who were prepared to make various concessions in the interest of surviving and to commit acts of the kind they would have avoided under normal conditions. Of course, all these aberrations do not appear in clear-cut form in Dernesse's case, in Dernesse's diary. It is not possible to liken him to the negative and sometimes very cynical types painted in such somber colors in his diary. Dernesse himself commits acts of the sort he would never do it, he would never commit it in normal life, yet they are sufficient to justify the conclusion that in extreme conditions, it was inevitable that Dernesse too should be confronted with the necessity of adapting to the situation. There are numerous examples taken from his own diary of such concessions, but here I will focus on just one of them. And I need some questions. So this problem, the problem of making principled choices, recurs when the figure of Sahak Efendi Aramyan looms up in Dernesse's diary. This name appears for the first time in October 1917, at a time when Dernesse and his family were in desperate situation, and the priest was deeply discouraged. When Sahak Efendi, he is a deportee from Antioch, he is also deported to Hama, and when Sahak Efendi learned of Dernesse's predicament, he immediately made him a present of 5 Ottoman pounds. This is a huge amount, 5 Ottoman pounds. At that time, the salary of the average of one ordinary employee is 1.5 Ottoman pound. And he made a present of 5 Ottoman pounds. Less than 1 month later, Sahak Efendi displayed the same generosity and devotion. He gave the priest, who was on the verge of dire poverty, another 3 Ottoman pounds and 20 liters, this is a measurement, 20 liters of wheat, that means 50 kilograms, 110 probably, 110 pounds, 150 kilograms. So he made a present of over 100 pounds wheat and flour, which at the price of the day was worth more than 3 Ottoman pounds. And late in December 1917, the same Sahak Efendi gave him 2 French gold coins and had 20 liters, again the same 20 liters of flour sent to the priest's house that very day. And Dernesse writes on this occasion, "It seems that God has especially inspired this man to help me in the last few months, and when I am in narrow straits, he turns up and takes me by the hand. In all my years as a priest and in exile, I had not seen a single rich man as benevolent as he is." We might naturally suppose that one of the rare stars shining in the firmament of the evil empire, or one of the heroes swimming against the current of immorality, had at least appeared in the pages of Dernesse's diary in the person of Sahak Efendi Aramyan. Once again, however, we would be wrong. Sahak Efendi Aramyan was an Armenian who had, in the extreme conditions of the deportation, renounced his faith and converted like the absolute majority of his compatriots in Hamas Alamiya environment, but also in the whole Bilad al-Sham, he was converted to Islam and changing his name from Aram to Mujhad. And in his diary, Dernesse is unsparing of Armenians in this category. He severely berates deportees who neglect their moral and spiritual needs, singling out apostate Armenians for special criticism. For him, of all human feelings, the best and most noble are moral and spiritual values. And he considers extinguishing and doing away with this component of existence the greatest of all ruins. But the person who had presented himself to him and extended him a helping hand was, however, noble in his intentions, someone who symbolized human ruin of this kind, the Islamicized Mujahid. But starvation and decline seemed inevitable for Dernessez and his family. In this situation, it is not likely that the priest from Aintab hesitated for long. In those agonizing times, he accepted the convert's gift and in the following weeks continued to repeat, to adopt his own perspective, that sinful act. Manifestly, by taking this step, Dernessez was compromising one of his principles. He would seem to have been aware of this contradictory reality when he wrote about his honest friend. Now I believe more than ever that if God wants, he can bring four children for Abraham from stones. In spite of all the failures and disappointments, Dernessez continued struggling to secure his family's and his own survival. The aid he received from friends, although extremely important, was clearly insufficient. He needed more. Truly, the conditions of existence of Dernessez and many others like him were still unbearable. He was unable to continue his career as a priest because the majority of Armenians in this region were converted to Islam. He started to work as a weaver. That was a craft that he learned during his young years, as many other Aintab Armenians, because many Aintab Armenians are weavers. But after major setback in deportation conditions, he has given up. The end of the war and the collapse of the Ottoman army was not foreseen by Dernessez. He was simply continuing his and his family's struggle to survive, but the task was becoming impossible. In Dernessez's case, it is obvious that uncertainty was absolute. Vulnerability to disease, poverty, and in addition to everything else, death. It's clear that the passage of time made the effort to survive impossible for people in this situation. Death hovered over them and would soon or later strike many of them down. Indeed, since the beginning of the deportation, the Tavukians, their Nesset's family, had suffered many losses. Many died. The list is very long. I will mention the names. Maryam Sulahyan, their Nesset's mother-in-law, Shoragat, their Nesset's baby daughter, Hagop, their Nesset's brother, Diruhi, Hagop's wife, Krikor, Hagop's son. And the basic problem of the other Sham Armenians resided here. They were largely without state aid and abandoned to their fate, with the result that the plan to resettle them in the Arab provinces turned into a catastrophe for the majority of them. The mass relocation of an entire people and its resettlement in a new environment constitute by themselves a difficult enterprise, one that rarely meets with success. It is certainly much more difficult to carry out an operation of that sort in the conditions of war, and in this case, in the condition of World War I. The unprecedented inflation and severe economic crisis create unbearable situations for even the local population. And for most of the deported, relocated people, the new environment became a zone of extremes that reduces life to a daily struggle to survive. The more time goes by, the further their ability to struggle diminishes, and the more deaths occur in their ranks. And to conclude, just one sentence, I want to say that Dernessez and Krikor Bogaryan's personal family microhistories afford us the opportunity to research mass violence from the perspective of the victim. Their daily jottings are windows that allow glimpses of the details of their daily lives and observation of their own evolution. They show us their families and other deportees' gradual weakening and irreversible decline, this time to plunge them, in their nurses' own words, into the endless abysses that are ultimately the crime of genocide itself. Thank you.